Pleased to welcome now to the Hugh Hewitt Show the leader of the United States Senate, the majority leader, Honorable Mitch McConnell, Senator from Kentucky. Senator McConnell, welcome back. Good to have you.
Hugh, glad to be with you.
I did not realize until I read your new memoir, The Long Game, which is really a pretty magnificent book, and I'll tell people about it as we go through this, that you were so thoroughly a baseball man. I got to tell you that I went to my first Nats game on Sunday, and I saw Strasburg win his ninth in a row, and I saw, you know, a walk-off, Jason Worth pinch hit grand slam, and Daniel Murphy's hitting near 400. They're a pretty good team to watch, but I thought for sure you'd be a Reds fan.
Well, you know, in Kentucky, we really don't have a team. In the eastern part of the state, they do follow the Reds. In the western part of the state, they follow St. Louis. I never really warmed up to either one of them and kind of lost interest in baseball over the years. And then the Learners bought the Nats from Major League Baseball, and I've kind of watched them, you know, build quite an organization from scratch, including two great drafts in Strasburg and Bryce Harper. And so I've become a pretty addicted fan, and I saw a good bit of the game you attended on TV. I've got a package down in Louisville where I can watch it when I can, and in Washington, it fits right in. You know, you get home after a long day, about 8:30, 9 o'clock at night, catch the end of the game, and that's extra afterwards, and you know exactly what you missed.
Well, I just think it's terrific that you're a Nats fan. I also think it was interesting, given the title of your memoir, The Long Game, it's linked over at HughHewitt.com, that you were a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. I always tell people probably the best interview I've ever conducted was with Vin Scully for an entire hour because it was the most professional interview I've ever conducted. He hit every mark anticipating them with perfect stories, and you grew up listening to Vin Scully.
Yeah, talk about the long game. Goodness yeah. Gracious. is this his last year finally?
Yeah, he has said it's quits, it's done, and I don't think he's going to be talked out of it, and let him go out in glory. He turned down the All-Star game this summer, but that is the long game. Let's get to your long game. You've been elected to the United States Senate in 1984, 1990, 1996, 2002, 2008, and 2014. In the middle of this memoir, you tell the story of a dinner you held on November the 8th, 1997, your 20th anniversary of election as judge of Jefferson County, and after you'd won a third Senate term, and you told people at that big dinner that the celebration wasn't a retirement dinner, but a halftime celebration. It's been 19 years more. You're not near being done, are you, Senator?
No, I don't think so. I feel like I'm at the top of my game. I appreciate the support I've had from my constituents over the years and from my Republican colleagues in the Senate in making me the leader, and now I get to set the agenda as the majority leader. So I'm certainly not looking at retiring. I think we've got an opportunity to begin to move the country in a different direction. And I chose the title "The Long Game" because I'm a little skeptical of overnight sensations who have simple answers to complicated problems. I've taken a different path from what seems to be fashionable in the era of Obama. You know, Obama was a one-term senator, and all of a sudden he's president of the United States. I think life for most of us is a long game, you know, and getting used to the inevitable setbacks that we have along the way, sort of the speed bumps of life, and finding out that rarely are those setbacks fatal, and keeping at it. So it's worked for me, and I think I had an early lesson that, Hugh, when my, you know, mother helped me come back from polio when I was just a little kid.
You know, my wife and I was reading parts of The Long Game to my wife. She did not know. I did not know about your bout with polio. She finds that amazing and impressive that nobody knows about that. And I don't think I've ever heard you speak about it. Have you done so on the floor of the Senate ever?
I may have. I don't remember. I've tried not to dwell on it because I did have a normal childhood, thanks to her. But it was really an interesting early episode. Actually, my first memory in life, Hugh, was 2 years after that when we made our last visit to Warm Springs. We happened to be in Alabama at the time. My dad was overseas fighting the Germans, and my mother was living with her sister in a little bitty crossroads that didn't even have a stoplight in Alabama. And when polio was like the flu, and then when it was over, you had some kind of paralysis. For some people, they'd end up dying. For others, they'd end up in an iron lung. Some people would completely come back. It affected my left quadricep and my left leg. And my mother took me over to Warm Springs, where the Roosevelts had set up a polio treatment center. And the nurses taught her how to do physical therapy on my leg. And they told her to keep me off my feet. Now imagine a two-year-old, a normal two-year-old, is beginning to want to walk. She literally watched me like a hawk for 2 years, from age 2 to 4, and kept me off my feet because they told her they were afraid if I tried to walk too soon, I'd end up in a brace for the rest of my life. An enormous commitment on her part. She must have treated it like, you know, being a drill sergeant.
But also, and, not only to keep you off your feet, but at the same time persuade you to believe that you would walk eventually, but you just weren't allowed to right then. That's the double edge of the challenge.
Yeah, and imagine with a youngster that age, a subtle message like that. But after 2 years of that, as I say in the book, you know, my first memory in life was the last visit to Warm Springs, where the nurses told my mother they thought I'd have a normal childhood. We stopped in a shoe store on the way home and bought a pair of low-top shoes, a kind of indication that I'd be okay. And so I was able to walk without a limp. I never was very good at running, but, you know, good enough to get around and without any problems, and played baseball as a kid and had a normal childhood. And, I always felt, Hugh, that that was kind of an early lesson in the that if you work hard, really apply yourself, you can get where you're trying to go.
I think at the end of the book, you write that the only way to fail in America is to quit or die, that these are the lessons your parents gave you. And I underscored that in my notes. I wanted to get it out early, and I have. But I also want to go back to this question of Mitch McConnell as leader. I am one of the big McConnell fans out there. I know you have some critics in my business, but I started in the radio in 89. You started in the Senate in 84, so I've been watching you for a long time. I'm hoping you stay in your job because you're awfully good at it. And I'm wondering, are you running again in 2020?
Well, I certainly think that's a good possibility. And as I said, I believe that I've been effective on behalf of my constituents, and also I believe I still enjoy the confidence of my colleagues. I've been elected unanimously every time, and I think we're making some progress for the country. Nobody notices it. One of my great frustrations, Hugh, is that all the presidential candidates out there beating up Congress, you think we aren't doing anything. I can tell you when we weren't doing anything was under Harry Reid. You know, we didn't vote.
We'll get there.
In all of 2014, the last year of the previous majority, there were 15 roll call votes on amendments all year. They hadn't passed a budget in 4 of the 5 previous years. What I said was, if the American people gave us a new majority, we'd open the Senate up, get it back to work. There's no longer any dysfunction in the Senate. And, you know, what are the American people saying when they elect divided government? I think they're saying, we know you have some big differences, and boy, do we with Obama. Obamacare, for example, is a classic example of something we don't agree on. We put that on his desk and vetoed it. We thought he would. But there are other things that are important to do for the country that there is some bipartisan support for. Unfortunately, none of that makes any news. People, I think they teach them in journalism school that only bad news is news or only conflict is news. But we've had a very, very productive year and a half under the new majority. I'll give you some examples. We put the Keystone Pipeline on his desk. I wish he'd have signed it. He didn't. We did trade promotion authority so that there can be trade agreements. They don't always get approved, but there can be trade agreements. We did a major rewrite of elementary and secondary education, the No Child Left Behind Act, which is so unpopular. We did a 5-year highway bill. You'd think that'd be easy. We hadn't done one longer than 2 years in 20 years. We did cybersecurity. We did a comprehensive energy bill. We've done the major heroin opioid bill. We've done a lot that were things that sort of needed doing, but the Senate was so gridlocked, nothing was happening.
Your colleague, Senator Cotton, took to the floor last week and had some took the bark off of Harry Reid. Your book, The Long Game, does a little bit of that as well, in particular saying that when Senator Reid said the war was lost, it was the most insensitive and regrettable thing to come out of Harry's mouth. And there's a long list of those things. What happened to him? He was not this way when he started. He was a Democrat, but he wasn't a terrible Democrat.
Well, you know, I don't have any trouble with partisanship, but I think these low blows, you know, for example, calling President Bush a loser, calling the war in Iraq lost when we had soldiers still fighting.
Saying Mitt Romney hadn't paid his taxes and then later saying it worked, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, saying that Alan Greenspan was a political hack. I mean, whether you're a fan of Alan Greenspan or not, he's certainly not a political hack. I don't, you know, Harry personally is nice. By the way, he likes the Nats too. Bryce Harper's from Nevada. So that's what we generally talk about in the morning when we open the Senate. But I think that kind of a bombast, particularly when frequently it's inaccurate, is not the way the leader of a party in the Senate ought to act. And so I don't like the rhetoric. And, you know, I always say if a scalpel would work, Harry picks up a meat axe. And I don't like things like breaking the rules of the Senate to change the rules of the Senate, the so-called nuclear option, which he did 2 years ago in order to pack the D.C. Circuit.
Let's come back to that. I want to make sure we get people the background on The Long Game. They've got to read this book. I think it may be the first Senate memoir I've ever read that is actually worth reading. I don't mean to offend anyone out there who's written another one, but this is more political science and history than it is just first person, though there is a lot of interesting first person in here, Senator McConnell. Let me start with the job. Before you, there was Bill Frist and Trent Lott, and before them was Bob Dole and Howard Baker, and I doubt if anyone's going to remember Hugh Scott. I barely do. I don't remember Everett Dirksen. There are so many different kinds of leaders out there that everyone reinvents the office, but I think a lot of Republican angst grew up under Senators Lott and Frist because they were so non-combative. Now, Mitch slapping is a term of art, and you do get combative when you want to. But do you agree with my assessment that a lot of the Republican angst in the country is because of the perceived non-combativeness of its leadership in D.C.?
You know, I don't know. I think some of the upset that people have is related to the fact that they aren't fully focusing on the fact that there is a president under our system. People need to understand that there's a limit to what you can do when you don't have the White House. I think of, for example, the suggestion of some that we shut down the government in order to defund Obamacare. What my friend George Will called the politics of futile gesture. In other words, you set up a mission that can't possibly be achieved, and then when it isn't achieved, rather than blaming the guy in the White House, blaming people like John Boehner or Paul Ryan or me for being insufficiently committed to the cause. I think people need to remember that the presidency is a very, very important position. Most things we do require presidential signature. There's one thing that doesn't, and that's filling a Supreme Court vacancy, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point here, but we can't completely change the country and go in a different direction without somebody different in the White House.
I agree with this. The only part of the book I may disagree with you on in tone is on page 205 when you call Speaker John Boehner a top-notch guy. Personally, I'm sure he's a wonderful guy. But in the 5 years of his speakership, he never appeared on the radio with me. He never kind of engaged. You know, you go out and you fight the public opinion battle. The Dean Martin Republicans don't fight the public opinion battle. And I think that's what tore the party asunder and made way for Donald Trump. And by the way, we'll get to that as well. But my question goes to the sort of balance you have to strike. I think you are combative. You get out there and you fight tooth and nail with these people. But maybe Trent Lott didn't do so much of that. And certainly Senator Frist, wonderful man that he is, heart surgeon. I know you have a special place in your heart for heart surgeons. After I didn't know you had all the bypass surgery. We have to talk about that as well. But combativeness is part of the job of leadership, isn't it?
It is. I think you need to do it with class. As I say, with a scalpel, not a meat axe. And sure, I'm a combatant. Every morning, I make an opening statement in the Senate. I frequently, on a virtually daily basis, point out the shortcomings of this administration. Things like how much regular Americans have fallen behind during the Obama years. The average American's about $3,000 a year worse off now than when the president came to office. The overregulation of our economy, the slow growth, is all producing this frustration and anger out there in the country. I'm a combatant. I try to do it in as skillful and articulate way as possible.
Now, there's a lot on President Obama towards the end of this book. I want to read to people from page 185. You write, President Obama is no different in private than in public. He's like the kid in the class who exerts a hell of a lot of effort making sure everyone knows he's the smartest one in the room. He talks down to people, whether in a meeting among colleagues in the White House or addressing the nation. He's simply a very liberal guy who is determined to move the country toward a kind of progressive ideal that Western European societies embraced decades ago. He has a bold progressive agenda, and if he can't get what he wants through the legislative branch, he'll work to do so through the bureaucracy. Another place you talk about Speaker Boehner putting the phone down as he drones on. It is not a complimentary a portrait of President Obama that emerges in the last third of the long game.
Yeah, well, you know, when he's talking to people like me, he shouldn't try to characterize how I feel about things. I mean, I know how I feel about things, and I've said to him on a couple of occasions, Mr. President, I know what I think. And that's not exactly what I think. You know, we'd be better off him not spending any time trying to convince me of things he knows he can't convince me of, and I don't spend any time trying to convince him of that, which is why Joe Biden and I were able to actually negotiate three rather significant bipartisan accomplishments during the Obama years. I'm glad the president deputized Biden to do it because, you know, Biden didn't spend any time trying to convince me of what he knew he couldn't convince me of, and I didn't spend any time trying to convince him. So we sort of understood each other's politics, and we got down to the things that we might be able to agree on, and we're able to do that with a two-year extension of the Bush tax cuts in 2010. The Budget Control Act in August of 2011, and the fiscal cliff deal at the end of the year in 2012. All of those negotiated with Joe Biden. We didn't waste a minute, not a minute.
There is a wry observation in here. You quote your dad as saying, ask someone what the time is, and they'll tell you how to make a watch and that it's applicable to Joe Biden.
It is, but what I also learned, Joe does like to talk, but when we were in a negotiation, it was different. You know, he didn't spend a whole lot of time droning on and on. We got to the point and cut out all the falderal, and we're actually able to get somewhere.
Let me go back to the polio thing for a minute, Mr. Majority Leader, because we recently had a debate over Zika funding, and the Republicans were characterized as heartless and not in a hurry to fix the Zika epidemic. And as I read your book, I thought to myself, do these people know that Mitch McConnell knows how important it is to get a vaccine for Zika, but that you might object to throwing $1 billion against the wall and seeing if something stick?
Well, you're absolutely right. We're going to act on Zika, and we're going to act on Zika quickly. The vaccine is not going to occur overnight. What can occur immediately, and they already have money to start doing this, is we need to engage in major mosquito eradication short term. That's the single best thing we can do quickly. But it's going to take a year and a half or so to develop a vaccine. The money will be there to do that. What we're trying to avoid is every time there's an emergency, the Democrats want to plus it up with a whole lot of irrelevant things. For example, Hugh, the original request from the administration had a couple of new buildings in it.
Okay.
We don't need any new buildings. So we pared those kind of things down, and we're going to act. The Senate, in fact, has already acted. We're waiting for the House, and we'll reach an agreement very quickly here and apply the funding that we think is appropriate to the effort.
Now I want to go to what I call the big three lessons of the long game. I make notes as I go through the things that people need to take away, especially young, ambitious political people. Number one, You can start late, but you can never start too early. Number two, the three most important words in politics are cash on hand. That's on page 177. And number three, the single most important word in the English language is focus. Take him in any way you want, Senator McConnell.
Well, on focus, early in my career, I befriended a guy who started a major company, became a Fortune 500 company. I watched how effective he was, and he said, you know, the single most important word in the English language is focus. Decide what's important, focus like a laser on that, and push the other stuff aside. Separate the wheat from the chaff, focus on what's really important. And I've tried to apply that throughout my life with a laser-like focus. I've never started late in a campaign, whether it was for the Senate in Kentucky or for a leader in the Senate. There was an old politician named Happy Chandler years ago who said you can start too late but never too soon.
Right.
And so I've never been a fan of late starts. Now, sometimes that works. You know, sometimes you can make a late entry, particularly if you've got a whole lot of money and you want to spend it trying to get elected to public office. Sometimes that works. So early starts and focus, I think, greatly maximize your chances of success.
As does number three, cash on hand. And this brings us to the fact that you're a First Amendment hawk. And from a constitutional law professor's chair, which I've been doing for 20 years, as well as yammering on the radio, I want to thank you for fighting the good fight, which finally succeeded in Citizens United, even though you suffered a setback. And I got to quote John McCain here because I wrote that down. John McCain said of you, there are few things more daunting in politics than the determined opposition of Mitch McConnell, and I hope to avoid the experience more often in the future. You actually beat him in the end. Has he admitted that to you yet?
Well, you know, we had a great war. You followed it from the classroom. I mean, we had a great war that went on for well over a decade over the First Amendment and what's permissible in campaign finance legislation. And McCain-Feingold, I actually lost in the Supreme Court thanks to Sandra Day O'Connor. And when Sam Alito replaced Sandra Day O'Connor, the Supreme Court shifted on the whole issue of political speech in the First Amendment as it applies to the campaign world. This was before Scalia's passing, the best Supreme Court on First Amendment political speech in yours and my lifetime.
Correct.
That is all endangered now.
Correct.
You have people like Clinton and Sanders running for office saying they're not even going to appoint a judge, talk about a litmus test, unless they know they'll overturn Citizens United, which is one of the all-time great cases in campaign finance history, absolutely spectacular case that completely changed the landscape, opened it up to more competition. And you and I both know that in spite of all the demagoguery that's been thrown at this issue, all it was about was corporate speech.
Right, and it returned it to the framers' design. It is back to where the framers had it.
Yeah, all it said was no longer is there a special carve-out for corporations that own media outlets to engage in free speech. Any corporation can. All it did was level the playing field between NBC and any old company that wanted to get involved in the political process. So anyway, the just another reason, in addition to a whole lot of other areas, that this Supreme Court vacancy is extremely important for the future of the country.
Which brings us to Trump, Clinton. It has been said, not by me, but by a lot of people, that the only person Hillary can beat is Donald Trump, and the only person that Donald Trump can beat is Hillary Clinton. I know you've made peace with Donald Trump as the nominee. Speaker Ryan isn't there yet. A lot of people aren't there yet. They're worried. They're worried primarily about the commander-in-chief authority. His 11 nominee list for the Supreme Court, they're all good people. Is that reassuring enough for you, Majority Leader McConnell, when it comes to the future of the court?
I tell you what we ought to be worried about. We ought to be worried about four more years just like the last eight, and that's what you get with Hillary Clinton. Four more years just like the last eight. There will be no change under Hillary Clinton. And, of course, the Supreme Court is the biggest thing the next president will deal with. I made sure of that by making sure that this president didn't get to pick this nominee and get them confirmed on the way out the door. But that alone, that issue alone, will define much of what America is like for the next generation. That issue alone is enough to convince me to support Donald Trump. And I think the list that he put out was outstanding. And I'm very confident he'll appoint the right kind of person to the Supreme Court.
Now, you're right about, let's go to the second issue about Donald Trump, though, and it's about being a commander-in-chief. You're right about George W. Bush, that he was astute, decisive, never wavered from his belief, not a great debater. But then you write on page 176, I think George W. Bush was an outstanding wartime president. I think it was because of his temperament, Leader McConnell. What do you think about Donald Trump as a wartime leader?
Well, he's a different kind of guy. There's no question about that. A different kind of guy for a different kind of year. But, you know, I think Donald Trump will understand when he's sworn in the limits of his authority. He'll have a White House counsel. There will be others who point out there's certain things you can do and you can't do. And it's not quite like, you know, making a speech before a big audience and entertaining people. And I think he's a smart guy. I think he's going to figure that out. So I'm not worried about it. What I am really worried about, Hugh, is four more years of Obama, which is, in effect, what we get with Hillary Clinton. I believe that Donald Trump will respond to the basic positions of the Republican Party, and that there will be constraints on some of the things that he would like to do that, for example, I and others don't agree with. So I'm really not worried about it.